This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
Don't worry what other people are saying. Don't worry if you don't have a plan. Instead, ask yourself, you know, what is it that you want to do? And then let's talk about how you can get there. You only do as well as your team does, and your team only does as well as you do. To me, there's no such thing as failure unless you're just being kind of grossly incompetent or negligent. And if I feel like I've done my best not to be incompetent or negligent, then how is something a failure if you're trying new things?
Today, I'm joined by Arik Chen, a creative writer and artist director shaping the way we think about design and culture. In this episode, we dive into how anthropology trained him to see beyond the surface, why he embraces uncertainty as part of leadership, and what it takes to navigate the complex world of creative institutions. Hello, Arik. Welcome in the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe where we are today?
So we are at the New Institute in Rotterdam, in one of our conference rooms on the sixth floor. The beautiful view of central Rotterdam.
I was working here for you. Do you like it?
Yeah.
You've been here for quite some years now.
Yeah, well, I'd say about 3.5 years at this point, and it's been really fantastic. You know, super, super rewarding, a bit challenging at times, but in general, really quite good.
How's life treating you at the moment?
Well, I'll give you a Dutch answer. Not bad, could be worse.
Can you describe what you do as a profession and how you came up to here? What are the steps in a broad sense?
Yeah, well, I guess I was always in the sort of architecture, design and cultural field. So I started in school where I studied architecture and anthropology and then design history, but then moving on to being a writer and journalist when I was in New York, writing for different magazines and newspapers, mostly about architecture and design, but also art, fashion and the cultural field, and as well as lifestyle. And just over time, I started being asked to curate projects and exhibitions. And before I knew it, the curating became more prevalent and I started doing less writing, and the rest is history, as they say.
Why anthropology?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, it made a lot of sense. But at the time, it was just a field that I was always interested in. I started with architecture. That was sort of my first love, I guess. But I felt like there was something missing. And while I was in college, I started taking some anthropology courses. It helped that the anthropology building was right next to the architecture building. And I realized I wanted to dive a bit deeper into that. And of course, looking back, you know, the combination was quite logical. You know, I had a real interest in space, but I also had an interest in what happened in the spaces. In the people that use those spaces and what that means for social relations and so on and so forth.
I don't meet a lot of people who studied anthropology. Would you recommend it to people to actually do it or to incorporate it more in education?
Yeah.
What is the value?
Completely. I wasn't thinking this consciously at the time, but in retrospect, it's been incredibly important and useful for me, at least in the sense that it gives you a better handle on kind of what it means. Well, a handle on all the different ways there are of being human. You really learn skills like empathy, like seeing things from other people's perspectives, like not taking for granted your own cultural biases and assumptions. It really opens your mind to completely different and entirely different ways of thinking, of imagining, of seeing the world. And that's been incredibly valuable to me. And I would argue that especially nowadays, when minds seem to be closing the way they are, I would say it's even more important that people are exposed to anthropology, or at least anthropological ways of thinking and seeing.
When was the last time when you actually thought about your study anthropology and that you used some of the lessons or the experiences that you had?
It certainly impacts me every day. You know, I think also, well, in the sense that it has really informed everything I've done since and that I currently do. I think in some ways, first as a writer or journalist, then as a curator, now as a director, you learn to kind of develop your, let's say, powers of observation. You know, every day I'm reminded of my anthropological training when I sort of see something going on. And, you know, I try not to get too sort of kind of wrapped up in it, but I try to maintain some distance so you can kind of think in a more cool-headed way about what's happening and what to make of it. Maybe this is where the calmness comes in.
Yes, because that's something that I feel when you come into the room, you're quite calm. Is this also something that your team experiences?
I don't know. You have to ask them.
What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has come up before. I mean, of course, appearances can be deceiving, you know. I don't always feel calm, for sure. But I don't see what the point is of not being calm, you know. It's a complex, messy world that we live in and that we're all inhabiting and trying to navigate. And you can be calm about it or you can be not calm about it. And I just prefer to be calm.
How do you make the decision or actually the practical way of not being in stress?
You seem very calm also.
Well, it's not my first episode anymore. This is probably my first.
No, you know, I think also we often aren't aware so much of how we come across, or there's often a big difference, a gap between how we think we come across and how we actually come across, right? Like I remember the first time, well, still to this day, you know, every time I do a public talk, I think it's an absolute disaster, you know, because But I've learned enough to know that, you know, while I'm no great orator, you know, I'm not going to get Barack Obama a run for his money, I'm not the worst either. And so I think it's the same with you. You probably felt really nervous your first podcast, but I'm sure you came across just quite well.
Yeah, of course there are some nerves. Otherwise, it's not a good sign.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm doing okay. How was the COVID period for you? Because you arrived 3 years ago and I read multiple articles that this was basically your entrance in Holland. And
yeah, well, of course, you know, everybody on this planet has their COVID stories. Well, for me, I mean, I was living in China at the time, and of course, that's where the outbreak started. So I did experience it from the very sort of directly from the very beginning. The first few months were, as with everybody, a bit uncertain. I was traveling a lot, and there was quite a bit of drama around that as borders were closing, and I was quarantined early on, you know. So and that was really novel at the time. But after the initial, and really it was a bit of a drama. But after I wound up back in China after the first month or two, a really interesting thing happened, which was, you know, for most of the COVID period, China had essentially eliminated the virus within the borders. I mean, there would be occasional flare-ups. There would be very targeted quarantines for about a year and a half. And so those of us who were there during this calmer period were almost living in a parallel universe. I mean, the rest of the world is going in lockdowns. You were seeing these horrible images of bodies piling up. And, you know, it was awful, awful. Meanwhile, then China, it was almost life as usual. I mean, we were going to restaurants. People were still going clubbing. It wasn't long before the Louis Vuitton and Dior were doing their big fashion shows and exhibitions with, you know, 1,500 people. And it was bizarre. I left towards the end of that period for the Netherlands. And it was after I left that then Shanghai went into that, you know, famously draconian lockdown that I think everybody heard about. In the Netherlands, it was still kind of the tail end of COVID, though a few months after I arrived, you know, we went into lockdown. I think this is early 2022. And at that point, we were the only country in the world that was in lockdown. And of course, that was a bit of a bummer, you know, to start a new job and have to kind of bide your time a little bit. But I mean, certainly at the Nee Institute, we've recovered really well. You know, like our attendance figures from last year, 2023, were 21% above pre-COVID. You know, we bounced back.
What is the secret?
And then some, actually. Yeah. What is the secret? I don't know. Obviously, there's the, you know, you try to do interesting programming, you try to create a welcoming environment. And I think if you sort of stick to that.
Was it the most challenging or one of the most challenging situation you ever found yourself in during your career?
I would not consider New Institute to be one of the most challenging periods of my life, because it's actually really been a real pleasure. And again, there have been challenges, but I think the Institute was already, I think, in a strong place, certainly discursively. I mean, one of the reasons I came here was because the Institute was doing such interesting things, and there was already such a strong culture of critical inquiry, of experimentation. of asking all the relevant questions around architecture, design, and digital culture, and the many sort of social and ecological challenges that we face. So the foundations were really, really strong. I have to credit, the amazing staff and, of course, my predecessor, Huss Boehmer, for all of that. I remember during my interview for this current job, I remember saying, I think the Institute is doing amazing things. Let's keep going with it. But I just want more people to know about it, and in some ways, that's what we've focused on. Of course, I think there were a lot of, let's say, stakeholders who maybe did not feel as close to the Institute as they could have over the years. And, we've definitely made a point of really trying to reengage with those groups while also expanding, the communities who we work with. But I think that's all kind of obvious stuff,
How do you deal with criticism?
Yeah.
You don't strike me as someone who is awake at night from something like this.
I do get extremely irritated.
Okay, that's good to hear. That's some resemblance.
Honestly, there aren't a lot of things that keep me up at night, because I find most problems are usually manageable. And when it comes to criticism, it does get to me when I feel like criticism is not coming from the right place, either because it's based on a misinformed or ill-informed perspective, or if there's some kind of hidden agenda that's not relevant, that I do find problematic. But constructive criticism, I really welcome. We all want to do better. We all want things to be better. And if there are valid points and useful ideas or useful discussions to have, let's do it. Yeah, really, we all need that.
Is it also something that you need or learn from a mentor or education, that you just put aside your feelings when someone has criticism with unfounded grounds? Because a lot of people get agitated, me of course as well, but then it also spins around and then you feel like, wow. Oh, I wouldn't say a victim, but then you want to come out of the underdog position. Perhaps.
Yeah. No one likes being on the defensive, right? What aggravates me about when I feel like being put on the defensive is that I find it really unproductive. It's a huge distraction. I want to look forward, I want things to happen, And when you feel like you're having to defend things that are maybe kind of groundless or not so strongly grounded to begin with, it's really kind of, it's irritating. But and I think, to your question, I guess I've been lucky enough that I've been fortunate to have been surrounded by a lot of really great, impressive people throughout my life, and I don't know if I can kind of pinpoint particular mentors, but there have been, of course, many of them. I think in terms of criticism, having been a journalist, for example, I know how the media works. When you're in the media, you also understand sort of the power of narratives, right? And you understand the narratives that people are creating and why they're creating them. And once you understand that, it becomes, again, more manageable. And this is not just when it comes to media, but any kind of criticism from anybody. So the key is to try to change the narrative, in a legitimate way. And that takes time. And I guess maybe I'm very impatient, but also patient at the same time.
When are you impatient?
Oh, like every second.
Okay. We still have some questions to go.
Yeah, there you go. Let's get to the next one. I can't wait.
Okay,
yeah.
Mentorships. Are you a mentor to someone?
Oh, I don't know. I would hope so.
What are values that you think are important that you directly or indirectly want to pass on as lessons for another? Is that anthropology, for instance? Taking distance, observe?
Yeah, but even beyond that, I think it's really just understanding other perspectives. Right. And also going beyond binary ways of thinking. There's one thing that concerns me the most, broadly speaking, it's how binary we become as societies, right? This leads to the sort of extreme positions that we see now, the fracturing of society, the polarization. It's really, I think, the fundamental crisis of our time is binary thinking, where you're right or you're wrong. It's us versus them. It's good versus evil, or, either or. I don't believe in either or perspectives general.
I have some do or die questions later on too. We'll do them later. You mentioned that the coronavirus or COVID virus was not per se the most difficult situation in your career. Can you give an example of what actually is something challenging for you?
Yeah, well, maybe let me add something This relates also to the sort of, let's say, healthy distance that I often try to maintain. Going back to the Corona period, one thing that I learned, you know, professionally, at the time I was really working on lots of different projects, like all over, though I was based in Shanghai. One project after another, you know, and of course I was working on them all remotely. And I had quite a number of exhibitions and projects that were opening in different parts of the world, in Miami, New York, Lisbon, and so on and so forth. And they were all opening without me being there, of course, because I couldn't travel. And at first, you know, of course, that seemed a little disappointing, but really fairly quickly, there's no point in getting riled up about it. There's, you know, there's nothing you can do. What it taught me was that, or it was a reminder to me that we do these projects actually not for us, you know, but for the people who will see these exhibitions or installations or whatnot. And that was a really kind of learning moment for me in terms of where I place my priorities when I do something. You know, even this past summer, sort of my last loose end from one of my prior lives was an exhibition that I had first proposed like 8 years ago, a big exhibition, the first ever large-scale retrospective of the architect I.M. Pei, you know, the architect of the Louvre Pyramid and, you know, National Gallery in Washington, et cetera, the Bank of China Tower in Hong Kong. And this was for M+, the museum where I was working for a while in Hong Kong. Finally, the exhibition was opening, 1,700 square meters. And I went to Hong Kong for the opening. I was there for the last 2 days of installation. And then the weekend came, and then I got a call that my mother had been hit by a car, and it was quite serious. So I had to fly back to Chicago, where she lives, immediately. So I missed the opening, but I think, you know, a number of people were like, oh, that must have been so hard for you to this project you've been working on for, you know, almost a decade to miss the opening. And of course, you know, family comes first. And so there was no question, you know, about the fact that I was going to go back to Chicago. But even beyond that, yeah, I guess I felt pretty calm about it. And it goes back to, I think, the Corona period, where I really sort of made peace with the fact that, again, it's not about me, you know. The show is there, it's looking good. Mm-hmm. It's gotten great reviews, and there have been lines to go see it. I think it's the most popular exhibition, an architecture show of all things. It's been the most popular exhibition at M+. So, you know, what more can you ask for?
Your mom gets healthy.
She is, she's progressing slowly but surely. There's still a very long, long road ahead, but her attitude is remarkably, positive. I just came back from Chicago yesterday morning. In fact, I was there for a few days, just to check in on her and also to take care of some, various matters. And I was really, it's amazing how positive she is when her situation is still quite difficult.
You talk a lot about distance and self-reflection. How much do you spend this on your personal development? How do you nurture your own talents?
Yeah, that's a good question. Of course, I'm constantly, you know, reflecting on what I'm doing every second that I'm doing it, right? That's as basic as just being aware and present when you're doing something. But I have to say that in the bigger picture, I've sort of learned to maybe follow my instincts a little bit. Well, I can say I've never had a plan. You know, people sometimes ask me, you bounced around quite, you know, a fair amount, and, you know, what do you want to do next? And I'm like, I'm always happy doing what I'm doing at that moment. I've seriously never thought about what's next professionally. And, you know, I don't mean this the way it might sound, but like I've never really applied for a job, for example, you know, like, of course, formally, yes, but, you know, I don't even know where to look for job listings. You know, it's always been, you know, someone contacting me and then, you know, we see what happens. But
why do they contact you?
I don't know. Yeah, I tend to kind of go with the flow a little bit. Like, obviously, it's not, it's all considered, you know, it's not done recklessly. Yeah. and randomly. I guess I'm fortunate enough that I find that we are in a world where there are so many interesting possibilities, you know, that I almost find anything could be interesting. And if I find it interesting enough, and, you know, I'm happy to give it a try.
Which doors have been opened and closed during the past 5 years for you?
Well, I mean, the past 3.5, I've been at New Institute, so I'm exactly, you know, where I want to be. And in terms of the New Institute, I have honestly found that the doors have opened pretty quickly. I mean, what's been kind of amazing is generally the amount of support and interest I've seen from people across the, you know, the various Dutch sectors in the New Institute. And I think that says a lot what the Institute has done in the past and also what it can do in the future. There's really no limit. And in fact, our problem is doing too much.
Yes, because you do quite a lot. Because I spoke to your team to make appointments and it's quite full. How do you do this mentally and physically?
I'm here most of the time. And even here, it's really quite busy in a great way because there are so many people to meet with, to collaborate with, to work with. And I mean, I guess your question is, how do you do it?
How do you still keep the energy, for instance? Do you do sports or?
Not really. Please, sports takes up so much more energy. Like if you're tired,
what gives you energy?
What gives me energy? Honestly, I think what gives me energy is just sitting around coming up with ideas, you know, brainstorming. And that's honestly what does it for me. And that's maybe possibly why we as an institute wind up doing, partly why we wind up doing so much, you know, because there are always so many great ideas and we want to do all of them. I think that really is the honest answer. And I guess if you want to take that further, maybe you could say that it's from this that I get a sense of purpose and that purpose is what gives me energy.
Can you, after this meeting, sit down, come up with the ideas and then just go with the flow? Or do you do this differently? How do you come to such a state of mind?
I don't know. Maybe it's because it
sounds easy for someone who is listening. Eric is sitting down and he gets ideas, and then all of a sudden, a new institute moves forward. This probably doesn't work.
That doesn't.
Let's why it work. Can we break it down a little bit?
Yeah, let me try to think of an example. Maybe I think fundamentally you have to come at it first and foremost with not having a fear or minimizing any sort of fear of failure you might have, maybe even to the point of being even slightly shameless, right? When we're brainstorming, I have no problem spouting out what might be stupid ideas, you know, and it doesn't matter. We're just kind of connecting random dots and almost throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. You know, that's the whole point of brainstorming. But you know, oftentimes you'll get a request. So, for example, last year we were invited to be artistic director for the London Design Biennale. And, you know, of course that sounds nice and it's really great, really an honor to be invited. But if, you know, it's a real commitment and if you're going to do something, you want to know why you're doing it, mm-hmm. right? And
because you were creative director as a position for that?
We as in the New Institute were the artistic director, and it was the first time they had appointed an institution versus an individual to that role. You know, we were thinking about, okay, so what, you know, we're drawn to this idea, but why, what could we do with this? And of course, at least one of the things that I'm very sensitive to, given my background, you know, having lived in China and worked all over the world and oftentimes in just in various different places, very attuned to kind of the growing geopolitical complexities, you know, and tensions that we have to navigate, especially as an international institution, which the New Institute also is, you know. The London Design Biennale, it operates on a national pavilion model. So different countries will, you know, take a space. So you'll have the Dutch pavilion, the India pavilion, the French pavilion, the South Korean pavilion, Emirati pavilion, et cetera, et cetera. And normally you would just pick a theme. We were asked to just pick a theme and then all the pavilions just kind of respond, right? And, you know, and that's totally fine, but it seemed more interesting. The question was, you know, can we take this idea a bit further? And instead of just announcing a theme, can we actually play with the format of the Biennale and see it, in fact, as a kind of microcosm of the current geopolitical landscape? Because you have these, you know, spaces representing countries ostensibly. And if we keep talking about how all of our global challenges require collaboration, why don't we make, you know, the theme about collaboration? And instead of just having the pavilions do something about collaboration. Let's see if we can get them to actually collaborate with each other. And how interesting could it be to see which countries wind up working with which countries, right? And of course, there's a little bit of a precedent with this, with Buckminster Fuller's World Game, you know, from the 1960s. And so we invited Akim Tan of the Amsterdam studio Play the City to create a game that the pavilions could participate in, an online game that essentially acted like a kind of dating app, you know, for the different countries, country pavilions to find each other, you know, see what they would create their profile, what they're into, what they're looking for, you know, and then come up with collaborations. So this came out of just sitting around and, you know, just throwing ideas around. And
please call me when you're going to sit down next time.
Yeah. Sure.
I love
You're more than welcome. Yeah.
In a different interview, you mentioned answering the question, what do you think is your greatest asset? You mentioned, I would like to say it's my towering intellect and whining smile. But in real life, it's probably more like an ability to deal with difficult personalities, which is both an asset and a curse. What tip do you have for people dealing with the assets and the curses?
Yeah, distance. don't take it personally. Yeah. And I think it's like, I find difficult people in some ways to be fascinating. You know, you sort of want to know what makes them tick. Like, why are you so angry? Or why are you why are these sets of issues or questions that are maybe not necessarily such a big deal so important to you? Why are they triggering you in such a way? And then once you understand that, you can just sort of, you know, I don't play therapist, you know, like I don't take it too far. I kind of let a lot of things, you know, when people sort of say things that might be a little bit rude or, you know, or uncooperative, I kind of just let it slide and try to explain to them, you know, what it is that we need in order to, you know, I just remind them of why we're talking, what the goal is, and remind them that we're actually on the same side and that we both, we're talking to each other because we're trying to reach this goal. So let's just focus on that.
Does it also work the same for you in a position as a leadership or responsibility? That if you, for instance, have this curse and asset mingle with your team, that there's someone that you feel like, okay. Because from the distance, I can imagine that you feel like, okay, but let it slide. But here you can't because it's your team. Does it?
Yeah, well, we've never had problems with it. So I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, I'll ask around.
No, I mean, look, I of course, you know, I'm not the Dalai Lama, huh? Like I do get irritated, like I said, and I do need to vent, and I'm sure if you've talked to enough of my colleagues, they'll have stories of me venting.
What do you do when you notice that you vented and it might not have taken the right course as you hoped?
You mean like
with your team or people? Is it something that you, if you shared your opinion in such a way that you think like maybe there was a little bit too bold, do you still take like a nurturing package afterwards?
Yeah. Now, I mean, I
or is it let it slide? It's I want to move forward like you normally do with.
Yeah, I like in the same way that I honestly don't have a real fear of failure. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, I mean, to me, there's no such thing as failure unless you're just being kind of grossly incompetent or negligent. And if I feel like I've done my best not to be incompetent or negligent, then, you know, how is something a failure if you're, you know, trying new things, which is what I tend to like to do.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that I'm not, I really don't have a fear of failure in that sense. I also don't have a problem with acknowledging when I've done something wrong.
Does it come with age or an experience?
Yeah. Well, I think as you age, most people at least, you know, maybe have a bit more perspective and are a little bit more grounded, have a sort of clearer understanding of who they are. And so acknowledging your mistakes is, well, at least theoretically, not as big a deal.
Do you feel responsible for this generation and the next?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's a big statement. Yeah, I mean, I think we are all responsible for the generations that come after us. You know, it's something that should weigh on us, given the current state of things, right? And, you know, well, we all contribute to the broader issues of climate change, et cetera, in the way that we can. But I think on a more kind of in individual level, I think it is important for those of us who have some experience to share that as much as possible. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you know, I have a friend who's just a little bit older than me, who was sort of fretting a little bit not long ago, you know, about her legacy, you know, because sort of typical midlife crisis kinds of things. And I think she came to the realization that, you know, for her, in fact, she has an amazing CV. You know, if you Google her, you know, her name comes up everywhere. She's done a lot of really influential things, but she's realized that, you know, the legacy is what she can sort of knowledge and encourage. Well, the knowledge she can pass on, but also perhaps just as importantly, if not more importantly, the encouragement she can give to the next generation.
Do you see yourself in the same position? Do you consider yourself as a personal brand?
As a personal brand? No.
Well, basically the question underlying is that people intend to ask you for positions, work, collaborations, but you don't exactly know why. But how do they find you? That's because you're a public figure somehow, like it or not. You also communicate your vision, your mission, your opinion. That would say, for instance, that you're a personal brand-ish, although you probably don't ever think about it.
Right.
Could you also continue your career without being in the public realm with opinions and such, be more behind the scenes?
Yeah. No, I mean, you really, what drives me is I like seeing good, to put it, you know, over reductively, I just like seeing great things happen. And whether it's me doing it or whether it's somebody else who I can help in some ways, you know, whether it's just putting them in touch with, you know, other collaborators or institutions or whatever, honestly, I'm just happy to see things happen.
When was the first time that you actually realized what you are capable of with your words, your writing, and your voice?
I mean, of course, when I was writing, it was always great to, you know, hear whatever impact you may have had, whether people telling you that they read what you wrote and it, you know, somehow changed their mind. To like, once I was told that a tiny little travel piece, like it was like, you know, 80 words or 100 words that I wrote for the New York Times, apparently it actually played some little role in helping to reelect the mayor of Seoul, South Korea. You know, so that like those kinds of things are fun. But yeah, no, I mean, I think, well, again, I'm always sort of looking forward. So if things have an impact, I'm really...
Do you deal the same with praise as you do with criticism? Just let it slide?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, of course, I appreciate praise and we all do. And in fact, I think it's important to give it. You know, I think like optimism often becomes self-fulfilling in the same way that pessimism does as well. And I think the more positive energy and encouragement we can give, the likelier it is that good things will happen, right? So, of course, I think praise is really important, but we have to keep it in perspective too, right?
So you mentioned that you wrote a very smart article about this.
Small.
Very, very, very small.
Yeah.
But you will never write a manifesto.
Ah, you saw that on Dazing. Yeah. The only manifesto I will write is a manifesto about, as I did write, is a manifesto about why we need to kill the manifesto.
No.
My only ideology is anti-ideology.
Can you share very briefly why? For those who believe in manifestos.
Yeah, I mean, first, we've had our fill of dogmatism. No, like we look back, you know, past couple hundred years, enough. I mean, you know, manifestos are kind of useful in terms of giving focus, et cetera, but they also have been incredibly destructive and harmful in the sense of creating and fueling extreme, totalizing, and even totalitarian views. And this applies to architecture the same as it does to politics. I mean, we're in the mess we're now in because we have adopted these sort of singular ways of seeing things We have decided that, you know, that there are right ways of doing things as articulated and dogmatized in manifestos. And when in fact, the world is much more complex than that and requires much more nuanced and complex responses. And let's just like enough of the manifestos, really.
I think I've touched the point.
And again, this goes back to the, I don't believe in either or, black and white. You know, manifestos are the ultimate in kind of binary ways in general, are the ultimate in creating in reinforcing binary ways of thinking.
And in a different interview, you mentioned architecture and design can change the world. What advice would you have to people my age between 30 and 40 and 20 and 30 coming up? What would you actually say instead of writing manifestos and talking to each other and nothing with the growth? But what would you advise proactively?
Well, of course, continue to talk to each other, but just as often talk to others as well. I mean, I think one of the real challenges of architecture and design is that, you know, there's no shortage of brilliant ideas. There's no shortage of talent. There's no shortage of good intentions, but we tend to be a bit insular. And if we are really serious about tackling the bigger social and ecological challenges, you know, talking to each other is not the way to do it. You know, and there's a lot of baggage that we carry coming back from the heyday of the manifesto. You know, we had, let's say, a very well-known starchitect here at the Institute not too long ago, of that sort of generation that emerged in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s, the kind of paper architecture kind of generation. Like, brilliant people, you know, lots of radical ideas and really huge contribution to the field, but also, you know, highly problematic as well, because their views were this kind of totalizing, you know, were sort of totalizing in the way that I was just referring to. And so this architect, you know, was talking about his work and reliving kind of 60s, 70s, and 80s when, you know, they were doing these radical experiments on paper. And yet, you know, it was all about architecture as a social and political act, but at the same time as an autonomous discipline. They were always defending the autonomy of architecture. Now, of course, the big contradiction there is that how can you be autonomous and social and political at the same time? And I think that is the sort of fundamental problem with that generation and its work, is that they never reconciled this contradiction.
What would be your tip for younger generations?
Oh, yes. So architecture and design are not autonomous. I think they do need defending in terms of their relevance and their interconnectedness with the constructed world. And by constructed, I don't mean just bricks and mortar constructed. I mean the ways in which we organize both the human and non-human worlds, the planet that we live on at all scales, from the individual to the societal, to the planetary.
Maybe this is not an easy question to answer, but in a very practical way, what would you advise to people when they hear this advice, but they're in the field of architecture, they're working with different generations with different perspectives? How can they make themselves loose from such a framework and actually make a difference?
Yeah. And therein lies the challenge, right? Because you're working to build your credibility in your discipline, which requires spending a lot of time in the bubble. But then how do you build your credibility outside the discipline in a way that allows you to really productively engage with others? I think it's about finding balance and always sort of reminding yourself to kind of get out there. Sometimes it's just a matter of, I think we overestimate the structures for professional development that we have in place, and we underestimate the kind of more organic ways of doing it, right? I mean, you don't, when I say get out there, it doesn't mean you have to go to every single conference on, you know, on homelessness and climate change and whatever that's out there. But you know, even in your social circles, you know, just talk to people and see where maybe there might be connections, or, you know, they might know somebody who might be interested in the topic that you're interested in, but coming from a totally different vantage point. Just go out and have a coffee and then see what comes of it. I mean, to be honest, for what it's worth, I said I've never had a plan, and I haven't, because my modus operandi has really been just to go out there and to just chat with people, and then things come up.
But I can imagine that for a lot of people, that you sometimes doubt about the fact that you don't have a plan, because there's this bigger expectation, like you mentioned yourself, that people ask, but you did so many different things. What's your angle? Did you ever thought about these points of feedback or, say, criticism, that you thought, like, what am I doing? Or was it again like, yeah, I really don't care. I'm following my intuition and I go from place to place, from position to position, which is so different from each other.
Yeah, you're asking me a very valid question, and I, you know, there must have been time. Like I'm sure I'm not as sort of flippant and casual about it as I'm sounding, but I'm trying to think back about when I was really questioning what I was doing and where it was taking me. And I think there was a moment when I was living in New York. I had been in New York for 12 years, and I had been writing for about 10 or almost 10 at that point. And yeah, I did have a little kind of, you know, early onset midlife crisis. And, you know, and I was in a long-term relationship that I just ended also. So there was all of that. And I was sort of thinking, you know, basically, and New York is amazing, but, you know, it had sort of written for most of the publications that I wanted to write for. And I was sort of like, basically, this is kind of my life until early 30s. So I was like, you know, either this is just what I do and I just keep doing this forever, or I try something new. And at that point, I was kind of going through this sort of rediscovering my roots moment. And this was 2008, and the Beijing Summer Olympics were that year. And there's all this hoopla. I don't know if you remember how prevalent that was here, but certainly in the U.S., you were hearing nonstop about, you know, these Olympics as China's coming out moment, and, you know, China was the future, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just picked up and said, why don't I just go to Beijing, you know, and see what happens. I was fortunate in that I knew as a writer that there was no shortage of demand for stories from China. So I knew I could easily, you know, just write lots of stories and, you know, and make a living that way. But I guess that wasn't following a plan, but it was certainly kind of making a change based on, you know, the sort of uncertainty about what I was doing.
How was a midlife crisis for you?
Which one? I have them every year. I guess this is what you're asking about, right? Your question about, have you ever questioned your plans or lack of a plan? And I guess I've always questioned what I'm doing, but it's never been clear to me what's next. So in that sense, you know, yeah, it has been a bit go with the flow.
What do you do when you notice that you have, like you say, a midlife crisis? What happens with you? What can others learn what you already learned? For everyone, it's different.
Yeah,
of course. But are there lessons that you think like, okay, sit down, do this because it helped for me, or reach out to such a person, or...
Yeah, so a good question. And I would absolutely not do that because that's too much relying on these notions of what you should be doing in creating the plan you should be creating. And I guess, for me at least, that's never worked. And when I see other people, that tends not to work either. So I would actually turn it around. I would actually tell you, don't worry what other people are saying. Don't worry if you don't have a plan. Instead, ask yourself, you know, what is it that you want to do? And then let's talk about how you can get there.
How many people did call you for advice in such a way?
Well, you know, when I was teaching, of course, you know, I'd have quite a few talks with my students, and of course, friends will call up once in a while when they're struggling a bit, or and I think my advice has always been the same. Again, it's what do you want to do, and also when they're a bit stressed out, you know, like I had one friend who lost a fairly high profile job not long ago, and she was very, very anxious about it. And I said, look, you know, I've known you for many years. You've never had a problem, you know, getting projects or finding yourself, you know, doing interesting things that also pay the bills. Just enjoy the time that you have off, you know, while you have it, because I can promise you it's not going to last very long because you're going to start getting requests, you know. And sure enough, you know, with 3 months later, she was calling me again, asking me if I would be a job reference for another job that she was offered, but she wound up getting. So
do you ever experience feelings of FOMO, fear of missing out?
Yeah, all the time. But at the same time, I also get gint, glad I'm not there. So it's a balance. I think as you get older, you still feel FOMO because that's really a reflection of your curiosity, right? But I think also after a while, you've been to so many events and so many different things that you kind of know what you would be, you kind of know what you're not missing also.
So you mentioned that you do a lot on intuition and you don't have a plan, do you have a dream?
Yeah, I have lots of dreams.
Dreams you want to pursue or dreams?
Well, I mean, one of my big dreams right now is you know, taking the new institute to the next level. And so that's what we're working on.
What is the next level?
Well, I think what really drew me here was the fact that, you know, I thought about it and I realized there's really no other institution like this in the world. And I'm not just talking about the cross-disciplinary aspect, the architecture, design, and digital culture, but which is pretty unique, actually, that this combination, which together, actually, you know, it's through these disciplines that we really create our constructed world. But and it's not just the fact that we work on local, national, and international levels, but it's also us being a kind of museum and institute at the same time. A museum in the sense that we have this amazing collection, you know, we do exhibitions, public programs, etc. But we also have this more kind of, let's say, policy-oriented side function around talent development, policy support, whether it's around heritage and archiving policy or creative industries, etc., etc. And that combination is really quite powerful. I mean, it really gives the potential for us to redefine the role of a cultural institution in society as being a place that's more than just about, you know, discussions, debates, and presentation, but also, you know, enacting some of the ideas that we discuss, debate, and present. So how to kind of really get that together and really push that forward is really kind of what we're aiming for, and we're taking it step by step because, of course, it's not as simple.
No, it doesn't sound simple. Yeah. It sounds quite big. What is not to like about your job?
Oh, I mean, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. Is that a good answer?
It's your podcast interview.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say nothing out of the ordinary.
What strikes you the most in a positive way?
Yeah, I mean, I think really this potential, I mean, what's also a blessing and a curse is this enormous, almost limitless potential that we have. I mean, it opens up so many possibilities, but of course, you know, it also kind of can be challenging in terms of being able to communicate who we are and what we do and finding easy ways for other people to understand that. Because it's not easy to really accurately describe us, you know, in 10 words or less.
Is it something that you still want to communicate better, or do you think, yeah, but this is who we are, let's continue?
Yeah, it's both. Yeah. I think on the one hand, we do have to keep communicating more and better. On the other hand, I kind of feel like if we just continue being who we are, the need to communicate more will decrease, right? Because people will gain a more visceral understanding of what it is that we do.
You don't like black and white. You don't like taking sides. So let's dive into the do or die questions.
All right.
Are you more rational or emotional?
Both.
Are you more on strategy or intuition?
Both.
Are you more a talker or a listener?
Both. Seriously, yeah, I'm not trying to be cheeky.
No. It's fine. Invest more in physical museum spaces or expand digital collections and virtual experiences?
Both.
Focus more on international recognition or local impact with the institute?
Seriously, I'm not doing this to be wry.
Dedicate a year to writing a personal memoir on your design philosophy or edit a comprehensive anthology featuring works of emerging designers?
Anthology of emerging designers.
Why? Could say both. I don't mind.
No, I just find that more interesting. But yes, in most cases, my answer is both. And I mean that sincerely, you know.
You're not the first, so I'm fine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this goes, you know, like I sometimes say, because sometimes we get these questions or we're pressured to define ourselves one way or the other. You know? And I say, look, for decades and decades, physicists argued about whether light was a particle or a wave. It turns out it's both. You know, and that's just the reality. It is both.
Writing a personal memoir on design philosophy or the impact of emerging designers. Would you still consider writing something like a memoir of yourself? Not because of it's me, I do so good, I have good opinions, but more for the education of and being responsible for next generations?
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I have been missing writing, and I would really love to be able to do more of it. It's really just a time issue at the moment. But to your point, I would like to write more about, you know, maybe not a memoir per se, but write more about, you know, so some of the things that I've tried to do in my, you know, throughout the course of my working life, simply because, you know, in all of the different projects or roles that I've had up until now, like I was there because I wanted to be, right? And I wanted to be because there was something that I really believed in doing, that there was a reason that we were trying this out. And, you know, there are varying degrees of success. You know, I would like, you know, I find every project that I've ever done to be an unfinished project, in the sense that there's always more. There's always the next level. There's always more that could have or should be done. And I would like to write about that because, you know, all of these ideas and efforts still stay with me. Like, I still believe in them.
If I hear it, it hears like it was all success and it was moving upwards. No, of course not. So I'm more focusing on what kind of a project or what kind of situation did you find yourself in that you thought like, well, my intuition told me to do this, but it went completely different than I anticipated. Not blaming the intuition, but wow, there's a lot to learn from this.
Well, I don't know if the never do it again part. In fact, I would say the opposite. I mean, all of my projects never turned out completely the way you want. It would be strange if something...
No, of course, though. You know.
And all of them I would do again. I guess one thing that I learned over time is that the conditions have to be right.
Well, I'm more focusing on that part.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have asked the question differently.
No. Yeah, no, but I got what you meant. And, you know, like when I first moved to Beijing, well, first I was just writing, but then I was asked to be creative director for this new Beijing Design Week. And it was it was really an amazing experience. I must say we did really, if I do say so myself, we did really cool things that I'm really quite proud of. But it was a challenge. It was a slog. It kind of, I did literally get sick from it. Like I got shingles from it. And part of that was because I was so determined. I believed so much in what we were doing. I was so determined to make it happen. And to a large extent, we really did. Of course, with the support and collaboration of many, many, many people. But I also realized that, at least for me, after a couple of years or 3 years of working on it, I had done what I could, and that the structures that we were dealing with were so rigid. We had managed to sort of maneuver around it a lot, and I felt like we had been successful in kind of opening up a lot of potentials and possibilities. But in terms of me wanting to do more, I had done all that I could in that context. And then right when I was feeling this way, you know, I got a call from Hong Kong with a really interesting project, which was M+. And so it made sense that it was time for a change.
Was it worth it, as in the physical changes that you felt?
Well, no, in the sense that no job should, you know, should make you sick. But yes, in the sense that afterwards I learned, and I learned how to manage that better, and I haven't gotten sick from a job since then, and not because I care less, but just because I don't let it get to me.
What did you learn? What is the difference that you now make?
So, you know, again, going back to this non-binary way of thinking, right? When this topic comes up, we often focus on the external factors that are making people burned out or sick, you know, the toxic work environment or the work pressure or whatnot, the external factors, to the point where it's almost taboo to talk about the internal factors, what's going on within the person that is causing them to respond the way they do to the external factors. And you almost can't say that, because then it might be assumed that you're blaming the victim, right? Again, it's one or the other. It's either wholly the external environment's fault or it's wholly the person's fault, when in fact it's both, right? And so I would say, you know, obviously the external issues need to be dealt with, and that's the responsibility of the organization or whatever the context is. But that's half of it. The other half is how you manage your reaction to that environment and the level of resilience that you have. And that's something that only you can be responsible for.
Talking about potential growth, have you reached your max? What is...
Never.
No. Good. Thank you. No. You mentioned the projects that you did, and you described this one, well, we were quite successful. How can you measure the impact of success? Because when you're in a team or alone and you work and you feel that you move forward, how does the audience see this? Do you know how to measure what you do?
Yeah, of course, there are all sorts of metrics, but that's, you know, maybe boring to talk about here. And I do want to know how many visitors there were, or how many, what the click rate was on, you know, all that stuff. But I think in the end, for me, it's people are still talking about it. People talk about it, you know. That's in some ways the most gratifying, you know, whether it's now, nothing makes me happier than when I, you know, when people come up to me and say, oh, I was at the New Institute for this program or this exhibition and I loved it, you know, really nothing makes me happier. But looking back, you know, when someone is still talking about something that I, you know, worked on years ago, you know, it's really gratifying.
Use your experience to write a book on your engage in heated public debate defending modern design practices, or conduct closed door workshops to quietly influence industry leaders.
Both. Sorry.
Would you rather be recognized more for your individual contributions or for your ability to elevate your team's skills and careers?
Both.
Why both? Why not your team?
Because they depend on each other. You only do as well as your team does, and your team only does as well as you do.
Our team can be seen as a family, or calling your team at work family is out of the question.
Well, that's one that's hard to say both to. I think I would lean towards calling a team a family, but I think it's also good to have boundaries.
Thank you. What gives you hope?
You know, I was reading something not long ago, and there was a quote by Zaha Hadid, of course, and went something like, you have to believe in yourself, but also you have to believe that this is a world worth making sacrifices for. I never thought I would be quoting Zaha on a question about hope, but I think that pretty much encapsulates it, in that hope draws from what you believe in yourself, but also what you believe about the world and the hope that is yet to be found in the world.
Thank you.
Dank je wel.
That was my conversation with Arik Chen, a deep dive into curation, leadership and the power of seeing beyond the obvious. Arik reminded us that supportive leadership isn't about having all the answers, it's about asking better questions. From his background in anthropology to his work at the New Institute, he has shown how observation, perspective and openness to change can be the most efficient tools in navigating creative industries. We also explored why binary thinking limits progress, how cultural institutions can evolve beyond traditional models, and why resisting rigid career plans can open up unexpected opportunities. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and spread the word, so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay. But standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.